I could just put this in my pocket? Actually, I have to kind of move around a little bit so you're going to change the slides for me? Okay. Today we're going to have a talk on prostate cancer for the internist, and this is going to be a case study sort of approach. I like to keep it informal, with lots of audience participation, and so you can't go to sleep. It will, I think, be a better experience for one and all. So, next slide, please. Just for general observation, the dream of all oncologists, and as you know, I'm an oncologist, and many physicians, is to cure cancer. But prostate cancer has become a condition with too many cures. So how could that be? Next slide, please. Well, the prostate cancer challenges two fundamental oncology assumptions, one of which is that the early detection will lead to a cure. And this is a fundamental concept, which is, I think, is still valid. But prostate cancer has called that into question to some extent. And the second concept that is called into question is the fact that a simple screening test and sensitive screening test for early cancer, such as the PSA, will result in early detection and more cures of that cancer. And this is also sort of a bedrock assumption in oncology. It's probably still true, but prostate cancer has called it into question. So the questions I have for the internist today is, who should have a PSA? Who should have a DRE, digital rectal examination? Who should have a prostate biopsy? Who should have prostate surgery, prostate radiotherapy, hormonal therapy, chemotherapy? Well, we'll attempt to approach answers on all of these. So first, the case study. Your father, age 55, has just seen his internist for a checkup. The latter included a digital rectal examination, which revealed BPH, benign prostatic hypertrophy, but no nodule. PSA was 3.5. The internist recommended seeing a urologist for a prostate biopsy. So what do you tell your father? See the urologist and take the biopsy. See the urologist, but don't take a biopsy. Wait 3 to 6 months and repeat everything. Get a new internist. You'll do a prostate risk calculation and get back to him. Okay, this is audience participation. Let's see a show of hands. How many prefer number one? See the urologist and take the biopsy. Nobody's surgically inclined in the audience. Okay, see the urologist but don't take a biopsy. Any votes there? Wait 3 to 6 months and repeat everything. A few hands going up with that. Get a new internist. No. Finally, number five, you'll do prostate risk calculation and get back to him. A couple of hands there. Okay, good. Next slide, please. So this, how many of you actually have done this to actually to get the risk of biopsy-detectable prostate cancer online? This is simple, and it's fairly new, so I want to show you how you do it. There is this study which included 5,000-odd men over the age of 55 who had, yearly DREs and PSAs, and they happened to take a placebo as part of another study for 7 years. All had at least one prostate biopsy by the end of 7 years. So this was a unique set of data, and they've set up a risk calculator which is available to everybody online. If you can't remember this web page, just Google prostate risk calculator, and you'll get your way to it. So then you enter 7 variables: age, race, PSA, DRE results, family history, prior biopsy, and whether or not the patient ever took finasteride. Next slide, please. And this is what you get. So for the patient in question, race 55, PSA 3.5, family history, actually had a brother who had prostate cancer, DRE was negative, no prior biopsy, and not taking finasteride. So here's what we get. Based on the data provided, the person's estimated risk of biopsy-detectable prostate cancer is 38.6%. But what's more important is that website also gives you an estimate of the risk of high-grade prostate cancer, which is probably the clinically most relevant piece of information. So the risk there is 5%. Okay, what we mean by that, we'll go on and see. But this is something worthwhile, and I think should be in the diagnostic repertoire of all internists, because sooner or later people are going to ask you this question. So prostate cancer, as you know, is the most common cancer among men in America. It's the second leading cause of cancer death after lung cancer. And in 2007, there were going to be 218,000 new cases and 27,000 estimated deaths. So this is a substantial health risk. The risk will increase substantially as time goes on for males greater than 65, because males over 65 are going to double in the next 25 years as our population ages and our health continues to improve. Now, the number has been known for many years that many people harbor microscopic foci of prostate cancer. This is done from autopsy studies of accident victims and so forth. And the figures are, and have been for a long time, that men over 50 have a 10% incidence of prostate cancer, which is incidentally discovered. And men over 80, it's up to 70% incidence. So these are patients who were never bothered by it. So prostate cancer, of course, confined to the prostate gland. We know the prognosis. Median survival greater than 5 years. Locally advanced, in other words, invading the capsule, invading the seminal vesicles. Usually not curable, but the median survival is about 5 years. Metastatic disease, bone mets, soft tissue mets, whatever, incurable, and median survival around 1 to 3 years. So this is definitely a potentially deadly cancer. So what do we know about the risk factors? Well, certainly age is the most prominent one, that the older a man gets, the greater the risk of getting prostate cancer. Race, ethnicity, it's been known for some time that blacks have a higher incidence and a somewhat worse survival than whites. There are genetic and familial factors, but they're probably minor. Diet, we actually really don't know. Diet, obesity, such factors as use of testosterone have been questioned. But the main factor really is age. Next slide, please. And here's a study, a SEER study, a big study, on the effect of race, which you see is not very great. We see that blacks tend to have a higher incidence of metastatic prostate cancer when diagnosed than whites, and they also have a higher mortality, but it's not a major factor. Next slide, please. So how do we diagnose, and what is the pathology? Well, the diagnostic tools, of course, are the PSA, the prostate biopsy, the fine needle biopsy. Transrectal ultrasound is sometimes helpful. Occasionally bone biopsy is helpful. We'll talk about the staging and the Gleason grade in a moment. The histologic subtypes, of course, 95% of prostate cancer, and usually when we talk about prostate cancer, we're just talking about adenocarcinoma, 95% of cases. There are a small percentage of transitional cell carcinomas, basal cell carcinomas, carcinosarcomas, involvement of the prostate by lymphoma, and even small cell tumors. Next slide, please. this is actually a drawing by Dr. Gleason, made years ago, and actually is something of an oncologic classic, because what Gleason noted is the fact that if you look at the biopsy slides of prostate cancer patients under low power, that they seem to fall into five different grades. And one, the best differentiated prostate cancer, there are small cells that are packed together. Gleason's grade 2 was larger cells with a little more spaces in between. Grade 3, even larger cells with even more spaces, more variety, more heterogeneity. And grade 4, mitotic figures and necrotic areas. And grade 5, really bizarre shaped cells, very poorly differentiated. So these are the five grades of Gleason. But he had another good idea, which, and that was that since the prostate pathologists are always reviewing multiple slides, and sometimes the cancer looks a different grade in one area than the other. So Gleason's idea, which turned out to be a very good one, was that the pathologist would assign the least grade and the highest grade to the different slides that he saw. So he would say, if all the slides look like 3, then he would call it a 3 plus 3. So that's a Gleason 6. If they all, if some look like a 3 and some look like a 4, then it would be a 3 plus 4, or so-called Gleason 7. So what you'll hear referred to is the patient Gleason score. And this is still a very useful and widely used designation for prostate cancer. So obviously a Gleason's 10 is the most poorly differentiated, and a Gleason's 2 would be the best differentiated. Actually, those scores are rare. Most of them are more in the middle. Next slide, please. So this is what it looks like. This is a Gleason's 2. With the glands piled on top of one another in a disorderly array of a malignant pattern, but with the glandular pattern well preserved and with the cells still fairly uniform and appearing not that different from prostate glandular cells. Next slide, please. Gleason's 4 shows more variety, more heterogeneity, more aberrant and large cells with mitotic figures, fewer glandular spaces evident, and less order and structure to the tumor architecture. Next slide, please. So what do we know about the molecular basis of prostate cancer? As you know, in other cancers, such as breast cancer, we've come a long way with molecular markers for breast cancer. We send the tissue for oncotype diagnosis, and we get back scores, and we make clinical decisions based on that. Are we anywhere close to that in prostate cancer? Unfortunately, no. There are some mutations that are known, there are some genes that are known, but there's no single gene has even been identified as a major gatekeeper, such as P53, PTEN, KRAS. These are important genes for other cancers, but prostate cancer has really not been successfully studied as yet. What about genes? Well, there are candidate genes and linkage studies such as these two, but this only affects a small number of families where there appears to be hereditary prostate cancer. Next slide, please. So what are the guidelines? What are you guys as the internist supposed to be doing? Well, for all men over the age of 50, you should be doing a digital rectal examination. Obviously, that doesn't require a referral to a urologist or an oncologist. And certainly, if a nodule is felt, that would require a referral to the urologist. And a PSA test for men over 50. If they have an life expectancy of 10 years. So if you see a patient who's 85 years old and has had two MIs and a stroke and is in a wheelchair, certainly DRE and PSA are optional because the yield clinical benefit would probably be low from prostate cancer detection. Next slide, please. So there are controversies, and one of these, of course, is that the PSA lacks specificity, although it's a highly sensitive tumor, and it cannot differentiate between the less aggressive or non-fatal, non-lethal prostate cancers and the more aggressive prostate cancers that need treatment. So what happens is, because we have, say, 35 million people a year, men taking the PSA test, the one we do about 1.6 a year, we've got a population of 25 million men with elevated PSAs and negative prostate biopsies. So This means that we're doing a lot of unnecessary biopsies, and we're driving up healthcare costs by doing these. So how can we be more specific, more selective about choosing our patients? But before we talk about that, I would like to mention why the PSA lacks specificity. As you probably know, acute BPH can cause a high PSA, a prostatitis, other inflammation, a recent prostate biopsy, recent cystoscopy, recent prostatectomy, bout of urinary retention, recent ejaculation, recent digital rectal examination. All those things can cause elevation of the PSA. So, and perineal trauma, it may be more common than you suspect. I had a patient in practice one time, a man who came every year. He was about 60, and his PSA was always around 3, and he came one year for his annual checkup, and his PSA was up to 6.5. And so I called him and said, gee, this could be something we need to look at. And a day or so later, he called me back, and he said, you know, I just remembered the day I came for my checkup was a Monday, and on that Sunday before, he said, I'm a cyclist, and I had gone on a long bicycle ride that day, and I wonder if sitting on the bicycle seat would be enough to stimulate the prostate and get the elevate the PSA. So I said, well, obviously there's one way to find out. Come back and let's see. So sure enough, he came back without the bicycle riding, and his PSA was back down to 3. So it is a very sensitive test, and so perineal trauma of different kinds, sometimes something is a non-traumatic as a bicycle ride can raise it. Prostatic infarction is another cause. Next slide, please. So what's happened as a result of the PSA being introduced? Well, the PSA was introduced in the late 1980s, and what happened was the incidence of prostate cancer went way up in the early 1990s. Compared here to lung cancer, which was coming down at that time, and colorectal cancer was coming down, and lymphomas and other tumors were staying about the same or rising a little bit. Prostate cancer took a big jump, and this was probably because of early detection. The overall incidence then settled down. But next slide, please. Let's look at what happened to the annual age-adjusted cancer death rates. For example, here's lung, which was, this goes up to the year 2000, went up, peaked around in the 1980, and then by 2000 was coming down because of the, presumably because of the decreased use of cigarettes in the male population. The prostate cancer shown here showed this rise in rising cancer death rates, but then declined. And this curve has continued to decline is actually now below what it was previously. And this piece of information is one of the pieces of evidence that's cited as the utility or the usefulness of doing a PSA test, that early detection may lead to a lower prostate cancer death rate. We hope so. Next slide, please. This is a kind of a complicated slide, but it estimates this study estimating the effect of the lead time, how much earlier you diagnose prostate cancer by doing a PSA, and how much over-detection there is. In other words, regular screening for prostate cancer advances the diagnosis by about 10 years. And about 50% of the screen-detected cancer would not have been diagnosed without screening. So the introduction of screening would lead to 60 to 90% over-detection of prostate cancer. This is from a European study. Next slide, please. So just to summarize, there is no cutoff for PSA. We used to send patients for biopsy if they had a PSA of over 4. Some people 3.5, others 1. But there really is no magic number because it's on a continuum. And It's useful to have, serial PSA values. And, of course, as we found out, the risk of finding cancer on a biopsy is directly related to the PSA level. The higher the PSA, the more likely you're going to find cancer on the biopsy. And even high-grade cancer, prostate cancer, is not rare with men who have PSAs of less than 4. So there's no PSA level below which a man can be assured that he has no risk of prostate cancer. Next slide, please. All right, so another case study. Your grandfather calls. He's 80 years old, and he's in good shape, and he has hypertension, had an MI 5 years ago. He plays golf twice a week in Arizona, where he lives. He went to his internist for a checkup and was told his PSA had increased from 3.5 to 4.8 and that he should see a urologist for prostate biopsy. He wants your opinion. So do you tell him to follow his internist's advice, to watch and wait, get a second opinion from a medical oncologist, get a second opinion from a radiation oncologist, or that you didn't read that chapter in your medical textbook yet? So let's have a show of hands. How many would have Grandpa follow his internist's advice, go for a biopsy? A few hands. How many would say watch and wait? More hands. How many would get a second opinion from the medical oncologist? Nobody wants that. Get a second opinion from the radiation oncologist. Nobody likes that. Next slide, please. Well, what's the data? This is a prevalence screen cohort of a group of men who were followed retrospectively studied to find out the natural history of prostate cancer. And there were 1,000 men, and the median follow-up was 55 months. And they estimated the overdiagnosis rate was 48%, and the lead time was about 9 years. The overall death rate for this group of men was 12.4%. Prostate cancer death was only 2%. So what they found out that was maybe most important in this study was that what is predictive of prostate cancer death in multivariate analysis is a high Gleason score, 8, 9, or 10, over 7, and a T3, T4 tumor, which means the tumor that is invading the seminal vesicles or invading the capsule of the prostate or is extended to the lymph nodes outside the prostate. Next slide, please. So your grandfather calls back. He had the prostate biopsy. The urologist told him the 6 scores were studied, and 2 of the 6 showed cancer, and they were Gleason's 3+3. He went for a pelvic CT and bone scan, which were said to be okay. The urologist has recommended a radical prostatectomy. Grandpa wants your opinion. So what do you tell him? Go for surgery, go for a second GU opinion, watch and wait, see a radiation oncologist, see a medical oncologist for hormone shots. You're going into psychiatry and don't know about these things. So how many would tell Grandpa, number one, go for surgery? No surgical advocate. Oh, one surgical advocate. How many would send him for a second urology opinion? No second opinion. How many would advocate watch and wait? More hands. How many would ask him to see a radiation oncologist? No one favoring RT. How many would have him see the medical oncologist for hormone shots? No hands for that. Okay, next slide. Let's see what the data is. So this brings us to something called the Rotterdam study, which was a large study which revealed that 50% of the detected prostate cancers would not have become symptomatic even if not detected, okay? And that if forwarding the diagnosis results in a 2% death from prostate cancer compared to 6% when the diagnosis was made at the time of clinical symptoms in a recent trial. So that was the 2% that we saw that died of prostate cancer. It is not necessary to diagnose all prostate cancer initially presenting with a low PSA value. So, I mean, Grandpa is still only 4.8. More than 95% can still be curable if diagnosed 4 and 8 years later. High-risk patients appear to do better with local therapy. By local therapy, we mean either prostatectomy or radiation. So the high-risk patients, the ones with the high Gleason score, the ones with the T3, T4 tumors, appear to do better with local therapy than with endocrine therapy, the hormone shots. Next slide, please. So what do we do for treatment? Well, basically, if the treatment of the cancer is localized, as you know, radical prostatectomy is offered. Radiation therapy is probably an acceptable equivalent, and we'll talk about that in a minute. Metastatic disease, there is no curative therapy, as you know. And in the 80 or 90% of the patients, the metastases will involve the bone, so that the patients may or may not be a candidate for bisphosphonate therapy. Basically, in the metastatic, or in all the groups, there are two kinds of prostate cancer, but mostly in the metastatic group, we deal with patients who have hormone-sensitive prostate cancer and hormone-refractory prostate cancer. Next slide, please. Now, there's a change here. Hormone-refractory prostate cancer refers to patients refractory to androgen deprivation. Now, androgen deprivation can be induced by either orchiectomy, LHRH agonists such as Zoladex, Lupron, or anti-androgens such as Casodex, Flutamide. But this is now referred to as castrate-resistant prostate cancer. Why is that? Next slide, please. The reason is that because it's been known for years that the LHRH agonists, such as Lupron and Zoladex, reduce the serum testosterone levels markedly, but they do not ablate androgen in the prostate itself. And what happens with patients who are on LHRH agonists is that the cancer cells develop androgen receptors that become exquisitely sensitive to androgen present. And the small amounts of androgen present in the prostate gland itself is actually what allows these patients to escape hormonal control. So they're not truly hormonal resistant, they're really castrate resistant. Next slide, please. So with early prostate cancer, greater than 90% have localized disease. The number of local procedures has increased in parallel with detection. Most men, particularly younger men, don't like the idea of harboring a cancer and are not comfortable with the idea of watchful waiting. And it was hoped that early eradication would avert suffering from metastasis and death from the disease. This statement is probably questionable, and the rate of prostate cancer deaths has not substantially decreased. It has decreased somewhat, and we probably are making more of an impact with prostate cancer deaths than this is more the conservative view. The benefit of PSA screening for asymptomatic men is unknown, and there are studies that will take years to complete to determine that. And we've actually had some studies that came out within the last year that suggest one was positive, one was negative in terms of PSA screening. So we have to be cautious about treatment recommendations for localized prostate cancer, such as Grandpa had. Next slide, please. We do know something about the watchful waiting. This was a study that was done with over 1,000 men over a period of time who had, for whatever reason, they either refused treatment or whatever, they had watchful waiting. But they did eventually get treatment, and they were a group that were followed. And what we see here is that the patients who were low risk, low Gleason score, local cancer, had a second intervention, did require a second intervention at 2, 5, 7 years, but it wasn't all that high. Many did not. On the other hand, the patients in the high-risk group, more and more of them did require some type of secondary intervention as time went on. So it helped to segregate the patients into risk groups. Next slide, please. This slide looks very, very complicated, but the answer to Grandpa's question is here. So bear with me for a moment here. This is the deaths from prostate cancer and all causes in a population studied who had baseline PSA and Gleason scores. So we have a group here that's over less than 70 and a group that's over 70. Okay? So, for example, and these are the PSA scores here, and these are the Gleason scores, less than 7, 7, greater than 7. So what we see here is the most favorable group, patient with a low Gleason score, low PSA, And we see this dark area is the deaths from prostate cancer. The lighter blue areas are deaths from other causes. Okay, and down here would be another group of patients. These are the ones over 70 who have a high PSA and a high Gleason score. And even in the older patients, the death rate from prostate cancer is much greater than the deaths from other causes. So where does Grandpa fit into this array of curves? Well, he's obviously over 70. He had a Gleason score of 4.8. I'm sorry, he had a PSA of 4.8, so he was low PSA score, less than 10. And he had a Gleason score of 6. So Grandpa fits in here. So if you can estimate, this is his risk of prostate cancer death, and this is his risk of death from other cause. So, you know, he's got about maybe a 15% estimate at his age. It would be maybe less of dying of another 15% chance of dying of prostate cancer if he does nothing, and 85% chance of dying from something else. So these are valuable, and these are you know, readily available in the literature for you to consult. Next slide, please. Okay, so what do we suggest for Grandpa? Well, one of the options is watch and wait, active surveillance. Watch and wait sounds kind of uninvolved, so we can say, let's say active surveillance. It's the same. But at any rate, here's a possible algorithm, one that I think you can take it for some patients. And do a PSA DRE every 3 months for 2 years, and then every 6 months, assuming the PSA is stable. And then the urologist would take biopsies at 1 year, and then every 3 years until age 60. 80, sorry. And then sometimes the urologists like to do transrectal ultrasound. But when do they intervene? If this is the scenario, they don't have to do anything. But they intervene if the PSA doubling time is high, I mean short. So that if the PSA doubling time is less than 3 years, in other words, this is a measurement of how fast the PSA is rising. Or if there's grade progression when they biopsy, if the patient starts out with a Gleason 5 and goes up to a Gleason 7, then this will be a trigger for intervention, either prostatectomy or radiation. Next slide, please. So this is a possible useful algorithm for you. So what about the brachytherapy and radiation? Well, there are two kinds of radiation. One, of course, is external beam radiation. The whole prostate is radiated. And brachytherapy, where they implant the radioactive seeds or pellets into the prostate. And this has been a very promising and probably very useful treatment that is actually most urologists accept as probably equivalent to prostatectomy, particularly in control of localized disease. Brachytherapy is obviously only useful for for localized disease. So how does it work out? All right, this is just one series. The low-risk group did very well with long survival, free of disease, about the same as prostatectomy patient. Intermediate, also about the same. And the high-risk patients, also not that different from the surgical series we'll see in a minute. Next slide, please. Here's a table comparing results from different centers and different studies. So this is not a prospective randomized study, but it's giving you ballpark figures for the results of prostatectomy, and they're looking at something called biochemical relapse-free survival. In other words, the patient is doing okay and the PSA is not going up. So that's what BRFS is. So after prostatectomy, at 5 years, 7 years, the results are good. With external beam radiation, if you get enough rads in, the results are better than if you don't get enough rads in. Brachytherapy with the pellets of the seeds is about as good as prostatectomy or the external beam. And the two together is not bad. They do, by the way, the two together, brachytherapy, if there's evidence that the prostate cancer has spread into the seminal vesicles or is invading the capsule or might be outside the prostate gland itself. Next slide, please. So what does the pathologist get after the prostatectomy? Radical prostatectomy, of course, he gets the prostate itself, the prostatic urethra, and he gets the seminal vesicles, and he gets lymph nodes. So the pathologists, they always are staging things, and of course if it's confined to the organ, organ confined is, the cancer is only in the prostate gland itself. If it's invading the capsule, or if it's invading the seminal vesicles, or if there are lymph nodes involved. So those are actually progressive stages of prostate cancer that the pathologist detects. Next slide, please. So what are the side effects from prostatectomy? Grandpa is going to want to know about that, so anyone would. So the bottom line here is how much, you can tell this is a British study because it says urinary function and bother in 1,200 prostate cancer survivors who underwent radical prostatectomy. Anyway, the urinary function score, you know, is, you know, bad at the beginning and gets somewhat better, but you never get back to baseline. And there's a significance, or there are some patients that, you know, remain incontinent, require pads, and have a it has an effect on their quality of life. Next slide, please. How about sexual function and bother? Well, again, the bottom line is that it's rather poor after immediately after surgery. It gets somewhat better later on, never gets back to baseline. Next slide, please. So now your favorite uncle calls. How many of you have a favorite uncle? No favorite uncles? How sad. Anyway, he's 62 years old and in good health, except for treated hyperlipidemia. He plays tennis 3 times a week in Florida, where he lives. He consulted his urologist because his frequency in nocturia had gotten worse. His PSA was 6.6. Prostate biopsy showed cancer in 4 of 8 cores, and his Gleason score was 5+3, or 8. Pelvic CT and bone scan were okay. Radical prostatectomy was recommended to your uncle. He wants your opinion. So what do you tell him? Watch and wait, or active surveillance, as we say. Or you want to know if he's sexually active and how important that is to him. You suggest that he sees a medical oncologist for hormone shots, that he get a second opinion from a radiation oncologist. He goes to the nearest university hospital for a second GU opinion. Or you tell him you're getting a lot of crank calls lately and you're having your phone disconnected. So how do we vote? Active surveillance, watch and wait. Any votes there? How about you want to know more about his sexual interest and activity? Yeah, this would certainly be appropriate. You go see the medical oncology for hormone shots. No hands there, good. Seek an opinion from radiation oncologist. No radiotherapy fans here. Go to the nearest university hospital for a second GU opinion. Any hands there? Well, it might be a way, this might be a way of getting him a somewhat more experienced surgeon, since he obviously is a candidate for radical prostatectomy. He's a young man with a high Gleason score. He's certainly a candidate for intervention. Next slide, please. So the big question is, does definitive treatment affect the outcome of men with newly diagnosed prostate cancer? This is a question that's inherent in the question from your father, your grandfather, your uncle. Next slide, please. So this is kind of the reverse. Again, this is complicated, but your favorite uncle is in here somewhere. This is a similar study that we saw before. Different data set. But it basically, the dark blue is the death from prostate cancer. This is mortality. And the light blue is death from other causes. Okay, so where does uncle fit in? So it just, you know, for example, this is the youngest group. And these are groups with a higher Gleason score coming down here, and these are years after the diagnosis. Okay, so patients who are young and have a low Gleason score have a very low incidence of death from prostate cancer, and a higher incidence of over a period of 15 years. Much higher incidence of death from other causes. On the other hand, patients with a high Gleason score, such as your uncle, who happens to be 62, so he's right in this group. He has a very high risk of death from prostate cancer and a relatively low risk of dying of something else with that Gleason score. So what this tells you, and these are useful for individualizing recommendations for individual patients, the aggressive treatment for localized low-grade prostate cancer does not appear justifiable. In other words, these patients with the low Gleason score up here, look how few deaths there are from prostate cancer, and how many of them die, in fact, of other things. So we should be selective about which patients. But the patients with the high Gleason score, such as this group, the really high death rate from prostate cancer without intervention. Next slide, please. There is one prospective randomized study in Scandinavia where they actually randomized to active surveillance or radical prostatectomy. And it was not a big study. I think only some 500-600 patients. What they did find was that the watchful waiting carried a higher mortality risk than patients who had prostatectomy. And when they individualized by age, what they found was that the benefit from prostatectomy was largely limited to the younger age group, the patients under 65. So, and the other older patients, it really didn't make that much difference whether they waited or not. So the younger patient who's high risk certainly should be considered for radical prostatectomy. Next slide, please. Again, this is kind of a busy slide, but let's just go to the conclusions. This is data on the mortality and progression data with the relative risks. And the conclusion from this study was that the absolute reduction in the risk of death after 10 years after radical prostatectomy is relatively small, but the reduction in the risk of metastases and local tumor progression are substantial. And that this benefit, as we saw from the previous data, the benefit in decreased mortality is primarily for men less than 65 years of age. So probably grandpa can get off without a radical prostatectomy, but your favorite uncle, who's 62, probably would benefit. Next slide, please. So who should and should not be treated for localized prostate cancer? This is a summary slide. You've heard this before. The high Gleason score should have intervention. The low Gleason score rarely require treatment. Intermediate, some do, some don't. But the majority of these men will die from competing medical conditions during a period of 15 and 20 years. Gleason score combined with PSA level refines the prognostic categories, and men who have a PSA recurrence following surgery have a high probability of disease progression. Next slide, please. So what do we do with the patient who has relapsed with prostate cancer? Radiotherapy following radical prostatectomy. This can be given as an adjuvant. For example, if the pathologist describes involvement of the margins or the capsule or positive lymph nodes, there are studies that show that you can reduce with adjuvant, in other words, doing the radiation right away after the patient recovers from surgery, you can reduce their chance of relapse. But radiation, pelvic radiation, is not a lot of fun for the patient, particularly after a big operation. So some urologists say wait for the PSA to go up, just do it as salvage therapy, give the radiation after whenever the PSA starts up. What about biochemical relapse and treating it with hormone therapy? So let's talk about the hormonal therapy just for a moment. Next slide, please. This is actually a slide about what happens after prostatectomy, depending on the stage of the prostatectomy, with four different centers combined. That if the cancer is organ confined and the capsule is negative, the results are very, very good. The cure rate is high. If the capsule is involved, it's not quite as good. If both the capsule is involved or a margin is involved, the results are not as good. And if the seminal vesicles are involved, the the results get much worse. And if the nodes are positive, then the results are even worse. And this is across the board in most centers. Next slide, please. So how do we prolong the remission and survival? I mean, in breast cancer and in colon cancer these days, we don't just operate on the patient and say, as we did, 25 years ago, and say, you've had your mastectomy, good luck. What do? We try to give adjuvant or helper treatments after surgery as part of surgery, radiation, hormones, chemotherapy, and we improve the, we add to the cure rate. These adjuvant treatments add to the cure rate. So where are we in terms of thinking about that for prostate cancer? So how do we prolong remission and survival after local therapy in high-risk patients? So this led to trials of adjuvant androgen deprivation, in other words, giving Lupron or Zoladex, and these were begun in the 1990s. Next slide, please. And the question became whether it's better to give early androgen deprivation for high-risk patients or wait till they relapse and give it later. What are the benefits? What are the side effects? Who should be treated? Next slide, please. Well, what is seen is that the PSA doubling time is probably a good guide to survival. If the doubling time is short, the risk is much greater for the patient. If the doubling time is long, the risk is not so great for the patient. Next slide, please. What is the androgen deprivation syndrome? Have any of you seen the androgen deprivation syndrome in the clinic? Let's have a show of hands. You're all asleep. Have any of you seen any old men in clinic? Come on. Half your old men in the clinic have androgen deprivation syndrome. What does it consist of? Impotence, osteoporosis, mood changes, maybe hot flashes, muscle atrophy, gynecomastia, depression, maybe some anemia. So this is a fairly common syndrome, and this is actually something that affects not only older men but middle-aged men as well. So. Next slide, please. We get the androgen deprivation syndrome if we give Zoladex or Lupron. Obviously, these are anti-androgen therapy. So, how bad is it? Well, this is a study that suggests the hazard ratios from androgen deprivation, that there may be increased incidence of diabetes, more cardiovascular disease, maybe more MIs, but you notice the hazard ratios here are not that great. Next slide, please. There's a study just actually recently published in the New England Journal, which is worth talking about for a moment, that is relevant to this question. The European group studied 1,000 men with locally advanced prostate cancer, and they were treated with external beam radiotherapy and anti-androgen therapy for 6 months. Then the patients were randomized to no further treatment or to receive an additional 30 months of Zoladex or Lupron. Actually, it was another LHRH agonist that they gave. And to look at the what is the effect of androgen deprivation. Next slide, please. So what they found was that there was a significant reduction in overall and prostate cancer mortality with the patients who got 30 months of androgen deprivation as opposed to those that only got it for 6 months. Never mind these acronyms here. This STAS is short-term androgen something. but at any rate, the highest mortality was in the younger patients had the longer, the highest mortality was in the patients who had short-term androgen deprivation, in other words, only 6 months of treatment, as opposed to the 30 months. And then if we look at the prostate cancer deaths, which is the lower two curves, and these were significant differences, so that the patients were more likely to die of other causes as well as prostate cancer if they took only 6 months of androgen deprivation as opposed to 30 months. So this actually is probably an important guide to treatment because people are given the Lupron and Zoladex for 6 months and 12 months, and it's been all over the... But probably, 30 months is better than 6 months. Next slide, please. Or 36 months is better than 6 months. What about side effects? Insomnia, hot flashes, sexual activity and interest. These were the same in both the 30-month and the 6-month groups. So there was really no overall quality of life was not really adversely affected by giving androgens for the extra 30 months. Next slide, please. So what conclusions can we draw? Well, androgen deprivation improves survival of men with high-risk localized disease who are treated either with radiation or prostatectomy. When to give the androgen therapy is still not definitively settled, but many urologists, many oncologists started in high-risk patients immediately after surgery or radiation. And the question about adverse effects, the conservatives say, well, maybe it is affecting their quality of life, but the data I just showed you suggests it's really not a major factor. Next slide, please. So in summary, what do we do for metastatic prostate cancer? Well, these are patients who present with metastatic disease for many, many years, or bilateral orchiectomy was offered. And this is still a very good procedure. It's a lot cheaper than giving hormone shots. And many patients actually prefer it to coming in every month for a shot. It's very cost effective, and it's a very simple, low risk procedure. We hardly ever give her diethylstilbestrol estrogen therapy anymore. We do, of course, give the LHRH agonist coupled with the anti-androgen Casodex or flutamide. And in very effective treatment, 80 to 85% of patients, the PSA goes down, the metastatic cancer improves, but yet these patients have a remission that lasts from a year, year and a half. I've seen one patient in my own years of practice who had 7 years of complete remission on LHRH agonist. Overall survival, the median is usually 2.5 to 3 years, but virtually all patients will eventually relapse if they don't die of something else. Next slide, please. So what do we do when they become refractory or resistant to the hormones? Well, actually, this was an important breakthrough. Taxotere prednisone has been shown to improve survival, and some people like to withdraw the anti-androgen. In other words, if the patient's on Lupron, give them 3 months off of Lupron to see if they get better. And there's some that the PSA will come down. It doesn't usually last very long. At some point, you need to think about adding chemotherapy or other agents. Next slide, please. For many years, there was the conventional cytotoxic therapy really wasn't of proven value. Then a combination with mitoxantrone and anthracycline and prednisone was shown to have an effect on bone pain, but not on survival. And then when that regimen was compared with taxotere and prednisone in 2004, there was a significant improvement in median survival from 16.5 to 19 months. So that's become the, next slide please, that's become the standard treatment, taxotere and prednisone for patients who are castrate resistant and who are seeking additional treatment. Next slide please. So what is our conclusion about metastatic prostate cancer? Well, in this TAX-327 trial, the taxotere trial, they saw a PSA decline of 30% or greater within 3 months. They also looked at pain response, and this is how the protocols are set up. So the PSA falling is still the most useful standard. Overall survival, though, has to remain the important, the primary endpoint for all phase 3 trials in hormone-resistant prostate cancer. So what are you going to tell your grandfather next? So you got to write him something. So he doesn't hear well on the phone, so you write him a letter and say, regarding your PSA and prostate cancer, we really haven't made much progress since 1990 when Willett Whitmore, the chief of urology at Sloan Kettering, asked the following question. Is cure possible in those for whom it is necessary, and is cure necessary in those for whom it is possible? Regretfully, your grandson. And you might add a P.S. Dear Grandpa, my birthday is next month, and I'd really like to have a crystal ball so I could understand these cases better. Any questions? call like that from your relatives about their PSA and their biopsies?
Thank you so much.